Eminent domain. It's not a term usually associated with helping homeowners. We usually hear it when the government invokes it to acquire property needed to build roads, sports arenas, airports, civic structures, or even shopping malls. But the city of Richmond, California, hopes to use this power, the power of government to seize private property for a civic purpose, as a legal tool to help stop foreclosures. The financial community has, of course, vigorously opposed this use of eminent domain. Other municipalities are watching this very carefully and considering the same move. And there's even a number of national organizations trying to help them do it. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. And over the next 53 minutes or so, we're going to get both sides of this story and take your questions and comments as well. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join the program. You can also reach us via email, talk@WPR.org, or you can use Facebook. Leave a post at the Kathleen Dunn Facebook show page. My two guests are Kevin Whalen, campaign director of the Home Defenders League, a national movement of underwater homeowners. Good afternoon, Kevin.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And Christopher Killian, managing director and acting head of the securitization group of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, hereafter known as SIFMA. Good afternoon to you, Christopher.
Good afternoon, John. How are you?
I'm okay so far, but the day is young. We'll see. Kevin, we'll start with you. What is the problem that your group and the city of Richmond are trying to solve, and why is it that eminent domain is seen as the solution?
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for having me on today. The problem that we exist to address, and that is severe in Richmond and many other communities, is the problem that the foreclosure crisis that's been going on since Wall Street recklessness helped crash the economy and the mortgage market in 2008 is still very much underway. So by many industry estimates, there's still 13 million people that are underwater on their mortgages, which means they owe more than their house is actually worth. And in many communities, particularly communities in California and the West, but in many other places too, people are deeply underwater, owing, you know, paying every month on a mortgage that's $100,000 or $200,000 more than the balance of the property is worth. And inevitably, being underwater contributes to the ongoing foreclosure crisis, which is also caused by the after effects of widespread predatory lending when people were sold loans with tricky terms that they might not have understood or thought they could refinance and get out of later, and the general economic crash that left a lot of people out of work and that they're still trying to recover from. Foreclosures cost not only families their home and often leave a home unnecessarily vacant, but hurt the property values of the people around them, decrease the tax and revenue base for their cities and states, and rack up a bunch of costs that accrue to the whole public, dealing with vacant homes, boarding them, the increasing crime. And so it's a serious problem for millions of families, and where it's most concentrated, which are certain geographies, and then particularly African-American and Latino communities that were targeted for the worst kind of lending. The worst aspects of predatory lending are suffering the most. So we're 5 years into the crisis, and homeowners have been promised relief through a lot of programs. And in many cases, people have been able to negotiate with their bank or use a federal program like HAMP and do some kind of loan modification that sometimes includes principal reduction, bringing the balance on the loan closer to what the house is actually worth. So it makes more sense for people to pay on it. But there's been too little relief, and there are some pools of loans that are spread out among a bunch of investors, and it's difficult to arrange what might be in everybody's best interest as a modification on the loan. And that's why communities led by Richmond, but with many more probably to follow, are stepping up and working with investors in the market to try to help purchase and refinance loans at fair market value in a way that would leave homeowners in their community with some equity. And what the city of Richmond said yesterday is that they want to make fair market offers to a number of servicers and have sent letters offering servicers offers to buy these loans, but they're prepared to use the power of eminent domain if they need to make these purchases happen so that people can have some of their home equity restored.
Well, we'll get into how that might actually work or not work, depending on your point of view, in just a little bit. But I want to get Christopher Killian in on the conversation here. Christopher, why haven't more homeowners been able to renegotiate their mortgages? I mean, it seems to me that there's a downside for the financial communities when properties are vacant and continue to decrease in value. There should be some incentive, at least, to keep people in their homes. Why haven't we seen more success with this?
Thanks for the question. I agree with you in that there is an incentive for servicers to work with borrowers and work out modifications that make sense. As a general matter, a loan proceeding to a foreclosure isn't in the best interest of anyone, be it the borrower to the servicer to the ultimate investor, if that loan is securitized. One thing that we've found in discussions with members and discussions on this issue in particular is that there's one of the hardest parts of this process is making that connection to the borrower who needs help. Servicers tell us that, for an average situation, they'll send 200 pieces of mail and make 50 phone calls before they get in touch with somebody. And as we've explored this issue in some other areas, we talked a lot about with some of the community officials about the opportunities for better coordination between municipalities and servicers in those communities where, a letter from that comes from the mayor's office or from some sort of official organization is more likely to be open than a letter that comes from somebody's lender who they are concerned about getting foreclosed on or something like that. And in other areas, that was seen as a good way to go, and I think there was some promising steps taken towards improving that sort of coordination.
But in the situation that we're talking about here in Richmond, California, the city is offering to buy the loans and or to see that they're purchased. I don't think they'll be buying them themselves, if I understand this properly. There's a third party involved here.
That's right.
And they would be buying the loans, taking them off the hands of the servicers who would get something. They wouldn't get everything, but they would get something. That seems like a negotiation that could take place. I'm trying to get to the point where the eminent domain part comes in here, because it seems to me like there's a negotiation that could take place here. Is that not happening? And if so, why not?
I'm looking at some data from Richmond right now that I think helps paint the picture here. So if you look at loans in Richmond that are in private label securities, which is the subset of loans that are targeted by this program that Richmond is considering, of the loans that are current, which is the primary focus of this program, 46% of those have already been modified, and 20% of those have received a principal modification. And to drill into the number a little further, roughly 45-46% of those loans have an interest rate right now below 3%. And a quarter of them have an interest rate below 2%. It's not a correct statement to say that modifications are not happening when approximately half of the loans that are current and subject to this program have already been modified.
Kevin Whalen, what about that? I mean, I understand that eminent domain is something, it's kind of this hammer that the city can kind of hold out there, but it seems like it would be in everybody's best interest if there was a negotiation. And from what Christopher is saying, it sounds like they've already made some progress here.
So I actually think it's quite likely it would make sense, even as SIFMA and sort of trade associations rail against this program, lobby against it, threaten to sue and redline. Communities like Richmond move legislation to try to stop it short at the national level, that some of their members are probably likely to take offers to buy loans at fair market value, particularly ones that are difficult to service because the ownership is spread out. So I think that very well may happen as a business transaction with some of these servicers. I know that's the city of Richmond's hope, without needing to use eminent domain in order to do it. But let me talk a little bit about the mortgage modification process. And I bet when you open up the lines, you'll get people calling and emailing who've had experiences with this. It's incredible, but it's still the case that in many cases, people go through a long and frustrating and sometimes humiliating process trying to get a modification on a mortgage where banks have agreed under various legal settlements for laws that they violated, like the 49 State Attorney General settlement after the robo-signing schedule, through the HAMP program, or just through saying they want to work out for their own financial best interest with borrowers and avoid foreclosure. People still have a story of, you know, I faxed all my paperwork and they said they lost it. And then I sent all the paperwork, but by the time they looked at it, something was too old, so I had to send it again and it all started over again. And many people who have had mortgage modifications, including in Richmond and all around the country, have had the lender alter their loan in some ways, but they're still deeply underwater. They're still paying on a loan that really doesn't make good economic sense to pay on something. I'm looking at one borrower's story who's the current borrower. And by the way, the program that Richmond proposed includes both people who are behind on their loans in some cases and people who have made every single mortgage payment all the way along. But I'm looking at one person who filled out a survey and offered his story. He's named Eduardo, who indeed had a mortgage modification, and his interest rate went down a little bit. But he still has a loan for $340,000 on a house that's now worth $110,000. Just as a business proposition, he really, you know, doesn't necessarily make sense to rent your house from the bank for two or three times what it's worth for years. And for that reason, these loans are valued on the secondary market when banks and investors buy them and sell them to each other at a discounted rate. So that loan isn't being bought and sold between different banks for $340,000. And what the city of Richmond is proposing to do is break through the problem of not having any one investor to talk to, or for people not being able to get the modification that might ultimately be a win-win for all parties, and settle a batch of them together. And, you know, it is strange to us, but it remains the case for whatever reason that there are many people that we help, that community organizations help across the country, that are working to get a loan modification that ultimately gets worked out and is everybody's best interest, but getting a hold of somebody who can really make a decision, at the bank or at the servicer in question takes something that's, sort of a public campaign involving, you know, marches and banners and calls and elected officials calling. And then there's a win-win solution at the end. And that's really, I don't know why the industry is making it so difficult to come to a win-win solution after all this time. But it's creating vacant homes in our communities and costing families their homes. And a lot of communities are tired of waiting for a global solution from the federal level and needing to step up and take some action on the local level for those that they can't help.
I'd like to get our listeners involved in this discussion as well at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Maybe you are a homeowner who has gone through a mortgage modification and you'd like to share your story with us. That would be something we'd be interested in hearing. Perhaps you live in a community that has a similar circumstance to Richmond, California. A lot of homes underwater. Haven't seen as much of that in Wisconsin because we didn't get as much of that real estate bubble as they did on the two coasts. But there are some homes underwater in the Badger State, and they're not all in big cities. Let's hear from those areas. If there are vacant homes in your neighborhood, how does that work for you as a homeowner? What's it doing to your property values, and what would you like to see done? 800-486-8655. What about this eminent domain thing? Do you think it's constitutional? Is it legal? Is it moral? Is it the right thing to do? Or is this a way to break through the logjam and make something happen? 800-486-8655. is the number to call. You can also use the email address talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I have two guests this hour. Kevin Whalen is campaign director of the Home Defenders League, and Christopher Killian is managing director and acting head of the Securities Group of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. We're talking with them and with you on the Kathleen Dunn program this hour at 800-486-8655. We have callers lining up, and we'll take those calls after a short break. I'm John Munson. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Urban and rural America don't always see eye to eye, and Wisconsin is no exception. Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert's guests talk about the divisions in our state. Also, find out about a Shakespearean rewrite of Star Wars. That's all coming up today on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Well, this is the Kathleen Dunn program. Kathleen's on vacation this week. I'm John Munson, sitting in for her. And this hour, we're talking about what's going on out in Richmond, California. The city of Richmond hopes to use its power of eminent domain as a legal tool to help stop foreclosures in this small working class town. We're getting a pair of perspectives on that idea from Christopher Killian, managing director and acting head of the Securities Group of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, and from Kevin Whalen, campaign director of the Home Defenders League, and from you at 800-486-8655. And we have a caller on the line right now. Dave is in Cobb. Dave, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. I wanted to ask a question about what is eminent domain mean? I'll hang up and take the answer out there.
All right. Kevin, why don't you take that one?
Sure. Good question. So eminent domain is a legal process that cities, and typically cities or other units of government, use all the time to buy private property when it's needed for a public purpose. So the classic would be, if you're building a road, you can and need to have, you know, all the say property in a straight line, or getting rid of a bunch of blighted property. It means the government and local governments have the power to purchase something, and you have to pay, you know, and all the laws about it in each state, you have to pay the fair market price for it. But the government can compel the buyer to sell because it's in the public interest. You know, you can't complete the highway unless that lot is purchased. And so the government uses eminent domain to purchase that piece of property. And while it's most often associated with taking some physical piece of property, it can be used on intangible or other kinds of property as well. So in this case, the city of Richmond or another city that used this program, if the servicers are offered fair market value on these underwater loans that are likely to become foreclosures over time, but aren't interested or aren't responsive to purchasing them, the city could use eminent domain to say, we're going to purchase this piece of property because the public is going to be better off if people are in loans that have home equity and are less likely to be foreclosed on. So it's
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Christopher.
Oh, sure. I wanted to just add a couple things to that and also respond to a statement that Kevin made before the break about how this situation was a win-win. So as Kevin just mentioned, you know, there's a variety of requirements for eminent domain, but, you know, on a constitutional level, there's two main ones which were mentioned, that there has to be a public purpose and there has to be just compensation paid to the owner of the property. And to understand the public purpose angle of this, it's really important to understand how this scheme that is being contemplated in Richmond works and who are the parties that are on either end of it. And so when you think about taking loans out of mortgage-backed securities, the question is, who owns those loans? Who are the holders of mortgage-backed securities? And one of the most significant categories of holders of mortgage-backed securities are individual investors through pension funds, mutual funds, 401k plans, and other sorts of retirement savings vehicles. So that's, you know, individual people on the end of this. It's not a nameless, faceless corporation. And so So the public purpose then is it's not just the fact that a person in a community has their loan forcibly modified. There's somebody that takes a loss for that on the other end. And in this particular scheme that they're working on in Richmond, there's a third party involved, as I believe you mentioned before, which is this company called Mortgage Resolution Partners. And those folks are going to get a per loan cut of this, and they stand to make millions and millions of dollars on this plan. And the city additionally gets a kickback as well. But all this money comes out of the pockets of individual investors. So the public purpose is not clear to us when there's a very small group of people in the towns that we've looked at. The likely targets for these types of programs are somewhere between 5 and 10% of the borrowers in the community. But the harm is to investors across the country, individual investors across the country. And, you know, you have to look at the other part of this as well. To the extent that a city starts cherry-picking mortgages out of securitizations, and you're as an investor or a lender, and you're saying, well, gee, what's my proposition for putting my money into this community through a mortgage loan or through an investment, you're going to have to put this new risk factor into your calculation. And you're going to have to say, well, there's a risk here that's not there, therefore I have to adjust the way I do my business here. Maybe I need a higher yield or you know, a higher interest rate or something like that. So when you look across the board, we don't see that there's a public purpose there. And as we understand the offers for compensation, they're far below what the actual value of these loans are.
Who gets to say in a case of eminent domain, who gets to determine what a fair market value is? Who says that?
A court ultimately determines that. So the offers that the city sent, and there's a letter that's been published that's a copy of the cover letter that the city sent to each servicer, describes the firm that evaluated the loans and did so based on the standards that they do for commercial entities, for many of SIFMA's members and other, you know, traders on the private market, and use those to calculate the fair market value. And ultimately, if the city someplace were to use eminent domain and said, you know, we've calculated that the loan is worth this much, a servicer could argue, just as a homeowner or somebody owning the vacant lot could argue, no, it's really worth that much. And what other comparable loans sell for would be one of the things that a court would look at in determining the fair market value.
And it's true, it's decided by court, but if you do not pass, if you do not show a public purpose, the eminent domain proceeding can't happen. And it's our view that there's not a public purpose shown in these programs.
And then that certainly would remain to be proven or to be decided in the courts, although it seems like, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm not practicing law on the radio, good grief, that would be horrible. But there have been decisions where, I'm trying to remember exactly where this was. I think it might have been in Connecticut, where a group of people who owned or thought they owned condos in a building got kicked out so that a shopping mall could go in. And that economic purpose for the city that happened to be there was deemed more important than those people owning homes. So
I think you're referring to the Kelo case in Connecticut.
Okay, that might have been it.
Yeah, where land was seized for a drug company that was supposed to build a large complex that was going to
right.
And it's, you know, an important thing to keep in mind about the Kelo case is, A, the litigation took 5 years for that to get finalized, and the thing that the company promised to build never got built. And I read an article this winter, actually, that said it's used as a place where they dump Christmas trees. Hmm. It's an empty lot.
But hang on a second. Yep. So, Kevin, this is going to go to court, and it's likely to be there a while. And in the meantime, you still have homeowners who are underwater and who may or may not be making payments, even if they've had a modification. If the modification is still on a much larger amount than they can pay, you still have the same situation persisting. So there's no silver bullet here. What happens in the meantime to these homeowners that you're trying to help?
Well, right now there are homeowners both in Richmond and all across the country who are struggling to make their mortgage payments on loans that are deeply underwater, so they're never going to catch up and have equity in their home. And every day that goes on, it's been going on, despite a lot of promises for relief from Wall Street and from the federal government, it's been going on for 5 years, but it's far from over. So every year, more families slip into foreclosure. And the sooner we can get relief to more families, the less that will happen. So people, you know, on the whole, continue to struggle, sometimes way past the point when it probably makes any sense as an investment, in order to stay in their home and keep a roof over their head and make good on their debts, and really want the opportunity to keep doing that, but at a rate that makes sense and reflects what the house is worth years after Wall Street brought down the economy.
Well,
you know,
on the
question of just the sort of public purpose, which is a, you know, it's a key threshold question. I think we can all agree that a city has an interest in not having a lot of vacant houses because of all the problems that vacant houses and foreclosures can cause. So if it's in the public interest to clean up or board up or resell a vacant house, if at a much lower cost you can prevent a family from losing their house and prevent that loss of wealth, we'd argue that's a smart and strong public purpose.
Okay. And we can continue to have that debate. We've got a bunch of callers who would like to get in on the discussion and some email also to get to. Let's see. Let's go to the phones first, and we'll go to Madison next and hear from Peter. Peter, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. And so to answer your question whether this is going to solve the problem, I believe the answer is no, and that solely is based upon the fact that the people who took the risk in the hope of a reward in this whole investment process are not going to learn the lessons that they need to learn to get them there. And that's fundamental to the basis of the economics around investing. You have a risk and a reward. If you constantly damp out the risk and promote the reward, people are going to continue to get themselves in this situation over and over and over again. And this is everybody who is involved in this process, everyone from the homeowner to the real estate agents to the appraisers to the people that wrote the paper. So it's just going to perpetuate the cycle, just make it shorter.
What about what Peter is saying? That's Christopher Killian. Let's go to you first, and then Kevin Whalen.
Yeah, I agree that there's no silver bullet, and I agree that this is the situation over the last number of years in the mortgage markets. It's not an easy situation for anyone involved. The way we look at it is, look, the best first step for anybody who's having trouble with their mortgage is to try to talk to somebody about it and to call a HUD-certified housing counselor. And you can find links to those folks through HUD's website. I want to go circle back to something that was said before the question, which is around vacant houses and the like. And I think everybody agrees that preventing blight is something that's in the city's interest and that the city should do. But I would push back on the point that a person who is in a home who's been paying their loan for the last 6 or 7 years is someone where their house will turn into an instance of blight in the near future. I think it's quite likely that that person's going to continue paying their loan. And as to the comments about, number of borrowers underwater from the beginning of the call, I think a number of 13 million was used. And by the statistics I've looked at, that number is from probably back in 2011, because the numbers of underwater borrowers have dropped about 25% nationally in the last 2 years. And my point there is not that the problem has gone away or anything like that. My point there is that housing markets are improving, and someone who's underwater right now may not be underwater tomorrow. And I think we need to keep in mind that housing markets are going in the right direction in this country, and there's a question as to whether this scheme is aimed at, a problem that existed in 2008 that, is being remediated in some way, which is not to say that the work is done and that improvements can't be made.
Well, in the case of Richmond, we're talking about less than 700 homes. I think 646 is the number somewhere in this pile of paper in front of me. It was between 600 and 700 loans that they were looking at. And so, if we can maybe stick to Richmond and look at those those numbers. We can maybe keep that in that kind of perspective on this. But Kevin Whalen, what about the point that Christopher made earlier, and the point that and then maybe we can come back to the point that our caller Peter from Madison was making about the idea that people are you know, they're in their homes and they're making their payments on these modified loans, and if this goes through and the city exercises eminent domain, and let's assume that the courts go along with it just for the sake of the argument, what is the incentive then for the people who write mortgages to write new mortgages in Richmond, because how will they know that, you know, I mean, it just seems to me that there's a fundamental issue of trust here between the between the lender and the borrowers, the potential borrowers, that is going to become a problem in the future. How do you overcome that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I appreciate the caller bringing us back to 2008 and the crash, right? So the entire mortgage market collapsed, and all of a sudden, people on Wall Street and major investors and major banks found themselves short on money, underwater, if you will, where tons of ways that they had sliced and diced and packaged loans, some of them made on deceptive and predatory terms, all came crashing down. And we as the public stepped in and changed the rules in some ways that weren't expected and bailed out the banks to the tune of first billions and then trillions of dollars. And, you know, they ultimately had to pay some of that money back, but they did just fine. Banks and investment companies and Goldman Sachs that were on the verge of collapse, it was an emergency, and we were told you can't let the whole economy and the whole financial system go down. Whatever mistakes people have made, we need to rescue them. Okay, well, I don't know if that was okay with me or not, but it happened, and it happened in a matter of hours and days. 5 years later, homeowners who, you know, in many cases did nothing wrong except buy a house for what it costs in their community. You didn't have the option of buying a house in California for just $100,000 because there were no houses. So you got to live somewhere, and that's what people did. Communities of color and others were also targeted by very sophisticated marketing to get into tricky loans that people didn't always understand. And some people were able to see through and protect themselves from that, and some people weren't. Some people were lied to. And so here we are 5 years later, and the banks are larger and more profitable than ever. And homeowners who have done nothing except struggle to keep up on mortgage payments that they can no longer afford are still suffering. So the programs, the loans that would be affected in this program that we're discussing now, if it happened in Richmond or someplace else, are a relatively small subset. It's, you know, 600 and some loans in Richmond out of about 12,000 underwater homes that are there. But there's some of the loans that are the toughest to modify because they're not owned by any one bank that can itself just make a rational decision. And there are loans. Some of the worst and most predatory loans are included there. So, you know, sometimes people have been making payments for a long time and get told you can't get a modification because you're not behind. Then they follow their bank's advice and get behind, and then told, well, now you have bad credit and we can't give you a loan. It's time to even things out for homeowners who, as taxpayers, contributed to bailing out the banks that got a huge break and got off the hook for a bunch of illegalities in the process. That's, you know, it's only fair, and it actually makes more sense rather than foreclose on a family and sell their house for what's going to be pennies on the dollar if it's a vacant boarded house, to work something out that's a reasonable payment that has equity, and the investors get paid exactly the amount they generally would when they buy and sell these loans to each other all the time.
Yeah, we're going to take another call here in just a moment. But Kevin, a couple of times you've talked about equity in a home, and mm-hmm. I'm just in 2013, You know, unless you're planning on actually cashing that equity in, either through some kind of a second mortgage or a refi or something like that, what's the value of the equity in a home? I mean, the bottom line here is that, and you put it this way yourself, you have to live somewhere. It's going to cost X dollars per month to live in a house. To some people, the only real advantage to owning a home over renting an apartment or a house or whatever is that you get to write the mortgage interest off on your income tax, provided you have enough other deductions to make it worthwhile itemizing. But the equity itself, that's a number, but it's not something that it's not something that's going to be putting money into my debit card account. I can't go to the grocery store and spend it. I can't buy a car with it. What good is that equity to the homeowner?
Well, it's a couple things. It's having equity or having something close to equity means it makes sense to keep paying on that loan, right? So it doesn't make sense if somebody owes, say, you know, $100,000 and are making the high payments to, or you know, if you're paying the payments to keep up with a $400,000 mortgage on a $100,000 home, that sort of doesn't make economic sense in the long run. And as much as people want to stay in the home where they're raising their family, they're probably not even wise to do so. I'll give you an example. In business, this happens all the time. So one building that was deeply underwater was the headquarters of the Mortgage Bankers Association, which found itself deeply underwater and went to their creditors and said, you know, it would make more financial sense for us to walk away from this. That's probably bad from everybody. Can we refinance to what it's actually worth? And they did so. There's no reason to, nobody heaps sort of moral opprobrium on them. It's business and how businesses operate. By the same token, you know, we fought for months and almost a year here in Minneapolis for a homeowner who waged a long public campaign to get a modification from one of the big banks. She owed somewhere around $180,000 on her home. She could pay a mortgage that was closer to its market value just fine and wanted to, had the money to do so. There was a house across the street from her that had been foreclosed on in a neighborhood heavily affected by predatory lending that had just sold for $9,000. So our argument was it really doesn't make sense to kick this person who was working two jobs out of her home and resell it for $9,000 or $12,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 when she could probably make payments on a loan that's, you know, in the mid hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that's a deal that banks have taken and are, you know, aggressively out there marketing and offering in a lot of cases. It's a deal banks have agreed to do more of that to get off the out of criminal prosecution and civil prosecution for the robo-signing scandal where they submitted all kinds of paperwork. But with these PLS loans, it's difficult to find exactly who gets to make that decision, and that's why it makes sense for public entities to be involved in helping to get it to happen.
We're late to get to a break. Christopher Killian, I want you to respond to what Kevin just was talking about when we come back, and then we've got a bunch of callers, and I have a couple more questions I really want to get to before the top of the hour. So everybody, including the host, will need to try to be more concise for the next 14 minutes or so. We'll take a quick break. We'll come right back with more with our guests, Christopher Killian and Kevin Whalen, and you in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up next hour, I'll be joined by renowned neurologist Richard Restak to delve into the question, can humor help us better understand the brain? That's next hour here on the Kathleen Dunn Program. This hour, we're talking about what's going on in Richmond, California. It's kind of ground zero for a new movement that potentially could see cities using eminent domain to help solve the foreclosure problems in their community. We're getting a couple of different perspectives on that. We have been talking with Kevin Whalen, campaign director for the Home Defenders League, and with Christopher Killian, managing director and acting head of the securities group of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. Christopher Killian, how about if you respond to Kevin, what Kevin just got done talking about, and then we've got Dave in Menominee Falls, whose call we're going to take in just a moment.
Sure. You know, I'd bring it back to your point about trust that you made before. I think that's a really important point. And again, that's kind of, in a lending relationship, trust is central to that. And the argument about, you know, banks being bailed out and all that sounds really nice, but it's a red herring in this context because the eminent domain seizures that these folks are proposing to do will not. The money will not be lost by the banks. It will be lost by individual investors who own the mortgage-backed securities who were not bailed out during the crisis.
But haven't they already lost that money? I mean, the value of these, actual value of the property that's behind these mortgages has dropped significantly. So haven't they already lost the money?
The value of a mortgage is not equal to the value of the property that collateralizes it. What we understand about the scheme they have they're working on out there is why we don't believe the just compensation requirements of the Constitution would be met, because they're offering values that are far below what the actual value of these mortgages are. And so again, it's money that's being taken out of the pockets of, you know, people saving for college, people saving for retirement, and it's being given to essentially a hedge fund based in San Francisco, with you know, this artifice of the city standing in the middle of it. And, you know, the way we look at it is, you know, I'll refer back to my numbers. 46% of the current loans in Richmond have already been modified. And is that enough? You know, happy to talk about ways to improve the programs we have now. Happy to talk about ways to improve connectivity to borrowers, like has happened down in San Bernardino, which is a place that looked at this earlier in the year and rejected it. But, you know, things that don't help, I'll just give an example. On June 15th, a number of servicers held an event in Richmond where it was one of these things where they're at the convention center or whatever, and they advertise it, and they want people to come in, and the servicers have personnel there that can do modifications. The mayor of Richmond held a competing event on the same day to talk about eminent domain. And so it's you know, is the city actually, you know, looking to help, or are they looking to push this plan for some other reason? I don't know. But, I think, again, it all comes back to trust and good faith. And, you know, when you break trust, like you mentioned, it's people have to respond to that.
All right. Well, let's get some more calls in here. A lot of people want to talk about this. Dave in Menominee Falls, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Go ahead.
Hi. Interesting program. I was somewhat amused by your one commentator's use of the word scheme to describe this use of eminent domain when the opposite side has been using robocalls, predatory lending, grouping mortgages into securities that, as I remember from watching C-SPAN, a lot of the legislators said nobody really understands these. But yet they were sold them. They were apparently within the confines of the law at that time. But now the other side, when they want to use eminent domain, that's described as a scheme. I kind of find that laughable. I'd be curious to hear his justification, because I haven't heard any justification for it yet. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Christopher Killian?
Yeah, I'm happy to respond to that. You know, as of today, approximately 80% of the mortgages in this country are funded through securitization, primarily through you know, government or government-sponsored entities. So securitization is not an unknown quantity. It's responsible for, like I said, 8 out of 10 mortgages that are issued today. And, you know, we can quibble over whatever word I describe this plan is, but again, the way we look at this is it's a group of opportunistic investors based in San Francisco have figured out a way to use a city and its powers of eminent domain to extract profits from individual investors. That's what this is.
Mm. We've got an email from Greg I'd like to get in here. Greg writes, "It seems to me that the only real winner when a mortgage is modified because a house dramatically lost value is the person who sold the place at the inflated price. The bank loaned a large amount, and while I'm certainly no fan of banks, it seems unfair to ask them to settle for less than the amount they loaned. Couldn't laws be changed to allow some recourse to the seller who walked away with a windfall profit?" Kevin Whalen, why don't you respond to that first, and then I want to get Christopher Killian's take on Greg's email.
You know, it's funny to hear Christopher inveighing against people that might make a profit by owning a loan, since that's exactly what his members, the members of SIFMA, are, I think, are not exclusively, you know, little old ladies or my pension fund, but major investors who buy and sell loans, and many of whom, you know, were involved in the packaging and securitization that brought the whole system down. Regardless, you know, now we're past that, and people do buy and sell loans on the secondary market for a given price. What the city of Richmond and other communities that pursue these local principal reduction plans are offering to do is to pay that price to a set of investors, to work with another set of investors who can refinance them into loans that make more economic sense, in that people will be willing and able to pay on them over the long run.
But what about Greg's point that the only real winners here are the people who sold this inflated value property in the first place, and what about that?
Well, you know, many of those folks probably, you know, they probably live someplace too, and so you know, are probably in all likelihood ordinary working class people, and like the people in the neighborhoods we're talking about, are, you know, also bought something in that time period or that paid that. So were you better off if you sold rather than bought a home at the very top of the market? Yes. But the point here isn't to sort of go around and judge as, you know, better or worse people each individual home buyer. There was a housing bubble that was created in no small part by reckless behavior on Wall Street, and people, as they always have sought to have a house and a place to raise their family, and want to be able to continue making their mortgage payments, have it make sense to do so, and have a place to stay and raise their family.
Okay.
One thing about this trust issue, just that what SIFMA has publicly threatened to do in raising credit rates for whole communities that modify loans using a program they don't like is really it's equivalent to a bully in threatening or, you know, predicting an increase in bloody noses if you don't hand over your lunch money. It's saying we're going to alter the way we do business beyond what's sort of good or bad business into penalize communities that that do public policy that we don't approve.
Okay, Christopher, I'm going to come to you in just a moment, but I want to. Nancy from Minocqua has, I think, a comment that kind of fits right in here. I'd like to take that first to make sure we don't lose it. Nancy, go ahead.
Yes, I just get very upset. I am one of the people that had a modification. I sent my paperwork to Chase Bank 48 times. The stigma that I have to live with because I modified a loan because my husband's a contractor and someone swindled him out of $55,000, and so we couldn't make our loan, makes me one of these people that has to feel like I'm less of a person. My first home was paid off by the time that I was 31 years old, and I had no loans on my homes until now. And I just think, you know, the banks, yeah, they took a bailout. They got a bailout quick. They didn't have to put papers through 48 times. I fought for 5 years, and I had to call my congressman in order to get my modification, and it finally came through. And I just don't understand that why there's that stigmatism towards us. These people that are investing in loans, they're taking a risk, like the stock market. They're taking a risk, and they're trying to make a profit. And, oh, well, they didn't make a profit because the loan, the amount of the home went down. So they can write that off of their taxes.
All right, Nancy, thanks for the call. Christopher, you've got about 40 seconds.
Sure, a couple points, and I'll respond to Nancy in a second. You know, as regards threats that were mentioned before by Kevin, I think what we're talking about here is just a natural reaction to, if you increase the risk of doing something, you're going to have, you know, a market is going to price that risk. If you want to make a loan to one person and another person, and they both have different credit profiles, you're probably going to have a different required, you know, you're going to have a different picture for both of them. You know, as to what Nancy mentioned, I'm sorry that was your situation. You know, but I think that the idea of risk is actually really important because, yes, you know, when banks lend, they take a risk. And I think it's actually better if everybody realizes after this experience that owning a home is not a riskless transaction. It's an investment that carries risk with it, and home prices don't always go up.
And we're running out of time here. Very quickly, what about the idea that, and I don't think Nancy's alone, that people are just not having a lot of luck communicating with their with the people that they owe money to?
Well, that's you know what I said before. I think what we found in San Bernardino and where I said before about talk to HUD certified housing counselors. You know, those housing counselors, that's what they
okay.
do.
All right,
and they can help.
All right. Well, you know what, gentlemen, we're really out of time. Thank you both for a stimulating discussion this afternoon, and also to our callers. I really appreciate your time, and we'll just have to keep watching the news to see how this all plays out. No doubt, it's going to court.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Whalen is campaign director of the Home Defenders League, a national movement of underwater homeowners, and Christopher Killian, managing director and acting head of the securitization group of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, also known as SIFMA. This program was produced by KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning. KP handled direction, and Rhonda Fanning handled program production this afternoon. Appreciate both of them as well for helping make this happen. By the way, if you missed a portion of it, want to go back and listen to it again, you can go to the Kathleen Dunn page at WPR.org and get the podcast version. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. A reminder that you are listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.